unsuspecting stranger had better know the truth of wrong from right. 'Cause the eyes of the ranger are upon you. Any wrong you do, he's gonna see. When you're in Texas, look behind you. 'Cause that's where the ranger's gonna be.
Hi, welcome to another edition of the 19th Hole Golf Show. I'm Ryan Ballingy. Get a hold of me on Twitter, at Ryan Ballingy. You can also find Golf News Net on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, and Snapchat at the handle Golf News Net. We are presented by BetDSI.com. You can find all of our work at GolfNewsNet.com, as well as in the GNN app for Apple and Android devices. And you can find most of our work on Yahoo Sports' Devil Ball Golf blog on sports.yahoo.com. This week on the show, we have a guest. And it is Shane Battier, two-time NBA champion, an all-time college great with Duke, and for many years, a unbeknownst to him, mortal enemy as I went to the University of Maryland for 5 years, much of it overlapping with his time at Duke. However, we have a great conversation. We recorded it earlier in the week about his foundation, his love of golf, and the parallels that he sees between the results of the PGA Championship and the other majors this year, to what he's experienced as a professional athlete, as well what he's going through in trying to become a better golfer now that his NBA playing career is over. We want to spend some time talking about the PGA Championship. Jimmy Walker obviously is our champion. He's our fourth major winner of the year. He completes a superfecta of four major winners this year that are all first-time major winners. It's the first time we've had that in 5 years, going back to 2011, and then before that it was 2003. And I have to say that this is probably the most dull of the four major championships this year. And I think it was going to be that way anyhow. And I say that because Baltusrol, I really did not feel is all that interesting of a golf course. The lower course is a very solid golf course. There's nothing wrong with it. There's just nothing really all that great about it. It's eminently fair, which obviously professionals like. There are not a lot of tricks. Pros love that. It's kind of long, but not insanely long. Pros are good with that. A lot of bunkering, places to aim off of, plenty of sight lines that made sense. I mean, all of it came together. The long hole, you know, the 17th at 650 yards, it was long, but not crazy long. You get there in three. A couple guys tried for getting there in two, but weren't able to do so. And then you had 18 is the bat, you know, the follow-up, the finisher par 5 that was reachable by pretty much everybody in the field. Couple of irons, fairway wood and iron, driver, and I think in Bubba's case, driver wedge or driver 9-iron one day when it was playing downwind. A lot of solid par 4s. Obviously, it's a 34-36 for the membership. It's 36-36, but for the PGA, they knocked down number 1, which is only 480 yards, and number 7, which is about 525 from where I played it on media day. I would think right around that number on the card for the championship. They made that a par 4, and that was totally reasonable. Both perfectly flat holes. Number 1 from an elevated tee really wasn't all that long for these guys. And so it made sense as a golf course. And that's why these guys raved about it coming into the championship. But it was also why Jason Day, Dustin Johnson, other guys didn't really get too into playing this golf course well ahead of time. When they got to Oakmont for the U.S. Open, guys came ahead of time, weeks, months ahead of time, to try to get used to Oakmont and the nature of the golf course and what they were expecting they would get from a USGA setup on what is one of the world's most difficult golf courses, making it only tougher. With the PGA of America, they set up the golf course like a PGA Tour event. There's some rough, like a harder PGA Tour event. Think about Memorial or the Arnold Palmer Invitational, where they try to let the rough grow up a little bit. They let it play slightly more difficult. The greens are slightly faster, but everything's pretty much fair. There's no tricks to it. There's not different, not attempting to have different green speeds from green to green or firmness or anything like that. There's continuity. It's fair. And that I think, because that is combined with a golf course that frankly isn't all that architecturally interesting, these guys were able to take a Monday off or take a couple of days off before going to see the course. Jason Day didn't see the place until Wednesday. Part of that was because on Monday he had planned to take off. He's trying to figure out time to kind of build in days off in a compressed major championship schedule. Obviously, he's not going to the Olympics, so he's got this week and next week off and doesn't really have to mind that much. He's really got 4 weeks off at this point. But for him, he wanted to take that day off, decompress after the Canadian Open and the Open Championship, and then get set. Then on Tuesday, he was going to come see the golf course. His children, Dash and Lucy, were sick. And then that evening at the Champions Dinner for the PGA of America, he was obviously the host as the defending champion of the tournament. Ellie had an allergic reaction and went to the hospital. They were there till 2, 3 in the morning. So Jason Day didn't see the golf course until Wednesday, and he looked absolutely exhausted. And look how that turned out. Beware not the sick golfer necessarily, although he always says he's under the weather, but beware the tired golfer. And Jason Day played brilliant golf, just came up a shot shy. Jimmy Walker played a tremendous golf tournament. I don't think this was something anyone really saw coming. If you were guessing, if you thought of, hey, who are some guys who are kind of long that are sometimes really straight? Jimmy Walker's one of those guys. So if you were creating a very long list of players that fit that very simple view, very simple prototype, then Jimmy Walker would have been one of your guys. So if you're a fantasy person, you love fantasy, and you hear someone say, oh, I got Jimmy Walker right, I'm so good. No, you're not good. You got lucky. You got lucky at best, because his form did not indicate a major championship win was coming. But it did. And now when you look on it, you go, okay, well, we said going all along, going into Baltusrol, that this was going to be a ball striker's paradise, that putting would not be as important as getting there from tee to green with some reasonable length and finding a lot of greens and giving yourself chances. Guess who did that? Jimmy Walker. And the interesting thing is that he set up really the finish with a hole out from a bunker. He drew a wonderful lie from the bunker on 10, greenside bunker, after coming up just short with his second shot. And all of a sudden, he holes out, he's into the golf tournament. After 9 pars, he's made a birdie, and he's feeling like maybe this could be his time. He drains a 35-footer on 11, right after Jason Day in front of him makes a birdie. So he tops him, he goes another one ahead. Meanwhile, you've got Stenson, who's going long and left and can't putt and flummoxed by the speed of the greens. And you've got Brandon Grace, who might as well have putted with a wedge into the house. And Brooks Koepka, who just kind of fell apart a little bit, especially with the double barkey there on what was the number 12. But he played a good golf tournament as well. But by the time we got to basically 3 holes left for Jason Day, who's playing a group ahead, the golf tournament was a 2-man race. And really, it wouldn't have been a 2-man race were it not for Jason Day on 18, making that eagle, going 2-iron, 2-iron to 10 feet, and really getting a rise out of the Jersey crowd, who I think, if you watched it on TV or you were there in person, you could vouch that they were pulling for Jason Day. They wanted a successful title defense. They wanted this guy to win. I think they were trying to root him into hero mode to kind of become, all right, he's a 2-time major winner. All of a sudden, we start thinking about him a slightly bit differently, and it just didn't work out that way. Jimmy Walker, birdie 17, sneaks it in on the low side, which was impressive. Even though it wasn't the best struck putt, at least it got in the hole. And then on 18, I go back and forth with Walker's decision, not of the tee to lay up with iron, that's totally fine, but to go after it with 3 wood to try to get to the green, maybe get there in 2 and put this bad boy away. If I were in that situation, I would have laid up. But I understand why he didn't, because he thought, all right, if I get on, I win. If I just miss, I'm going to get one, and I'm going to win. But if I screw up laying up, then I can miss and miss again. So you really only have one more miss in you if you go for it and don't, like, top it into the water, which obviously he's not thinking about. And if he lays up with a mid-iron or a longer iron to 50, 75 yards and nukes one over the green by accident or comes up short, that par looks awfully difficult. Looks a lot easier when you just have to get up and down for your third shot, for birdie to win or par to win. So I understand why he did it, but I would not have done it that way, and I don't know that many people would have done it that way. But again, it worked. The whole approach worked. Jimmy Walker's play the entire week worked. He gained strokes from tee to green. Wasn't necessarily the best putter. That wasn't required here. That wasn't necessary. I think that it was more difficult for the guys on Sunday to make putts because they came into the week expecting green speeds in the 14 range on the stint meter. And they got it for day one, and the top score was 65. And then, obviously, it softened up. We got a 63 out of Robert Streb. Then we get the rain on Saturday. We get the 36-hole marathon on Sunday. So it was even slower, I think, on Sunday for these guys, and they just couldn't get used to it. They couldn't stop leaving putts short, basically in the heart, if they just hit it 3 to 7 inches farther, which was remarkable. But I think that helped Jimmy Walker because no one could really make a move, not only on the putting greens unless you put it stone dead, which a bunch of guys did, but not every shot. It also helped that the rough wasn't longer, but it was wetter throughout the course of the week. So the more moisture that rough took on, the more likely you were to get a lie where your ball was in between patches of grass or in between pieces of grass. I shouldn't say patches. I mean, the golf course was immaculate. But relatively speaking, patches of grass. So you weren't necessarily going to get the club head on the ball cleanly each time. And that made the golf course, already playing longer, more difficult. So it was tough for anyone to really make a run at Jimmy Walker on Sunday. Jimmy Walker also made it difficult to make a run at him. He shot a bogey-free 67. I mean, he played what amounted to perfect, albeit somewhat boring, golf to win the championship. That's what you're supposed to do when you're winning. That's what you're supposed to do when you're ahead. Make people come get you, and then you respond in kind. And that's what Jimmy Walker did. He played the major correctly. And I think the only downside to all of this, and obviously this is the big glaring error, this is the but part, and that is that there was no repair after the third round, because the nature of the rain and the effort to get this thing done on Sunday forced the PGA of America, which should have seen the rain on Saturday coming. They should have gone threesomes off 1 and 10. We would have been done before they called play, just working out the easy math. But they didn't do that because they thought for some reason the rain wasn't coming. And they thought the same thing for Sunday. Rain's not coming. We're going to get it done. Now, I don't know why they thought that. I don't know who the meteorologist they work with at the PGA of America is, on staff or not, but they should stop working with that person because they were terribly wrong all week about the weather. But with that terribly wrong forecast in hand, they went ahead and said, okay, well, we're going to basically run a shotgun start on Sunday. We're going to get everyone back on the golf course where they were, and we're going to cycle those final five groups on that didn't get to tee off, and we're going to press play, and we're just going to keep going until everyone finishes. Two rounds, same day. And I think for Jason Day, I know that he wanted to play with Jimmy Walker, repaired in the final round. It makes it easier for Jason Day, a guy who is a known closer, maybe not Tiger-level closer, but a known closer, to come in that final group with Jimmy Walker and go, hey, mate, done it before, and it was in this tournament last year, and it was a guy who's better than you, and I'm going to take you down. And instead, Jimmy Walker didn't have to see that. He didn't have to see Jason Day make eagle on 18. He didn't have to see all of the good shots Jason Day hit in to the holes, especially on the back nine. And all he had to really deal with was Bob Streb, who was at no point in the day a threat to win the championship. And I mean through the day, like from the start of the day to the end of the day, all two rounds they played together, he was not a threat. So it was a comfortable pairing for Jimmy Walker, and it made it a little bit easier to try to win his first major championship. You can't put an asterisk by it. There's no need for that. He won fair and square. That's not the problem. But I think this would have been a more compelling battle and maybe a different outcome had Jason Day been the guy that was in that final pairing with Bob Streb instead of playing a group ahead with Emiliano Grillo. Both those guys, be a Grillo and Streb together in the next last group, I think they probably would have shot 80 each. I mean, they just weren't playing good golf, but they weren't playing completely irrelevant golf. They just weren't playing golf relevant to the championship on Saturday or Sunday. So now we've got four first-time major winners this year. Jimmy Walker, before that Henrik Stenson, before that Dustin Johnson, before that Danny Willett. So all guys kind of late 20s, early 30s, mid 30s, and 40. It's pretty interesting makeup this year. And you got two Americans, you got two Europeans. That's cool in a Ryder Cup year. I really have to take a second to give some shout out to a commendation to the ground staff at Baltusrol. I don't know the extent, let me put it that way, of what they did on Saturday night and Sunday morning, tirelessly working to get that golf course to a playable condition. But by the time things started, it's 7 a.m. on Friday, or excuse me, Sunday morning, that golf course looked about as good as it was going to get. And it held up. And there weren't complaints. I mean, the greens were slow, obviously, but everyone knew that was going to happen. They did an incredible job. And I will tell anybody, I've said it multiple times, anyone will listen, those guys deserve a lot of credit, guys and girls. They deserve a lot of credit for getting that golf course to that standard. And they did it probably thinking that it was for nothing, because the weather forecast called for more rain and heavy rain throughout the day. Like some in the morning, it would back off a little bit, and then around 1, the original forecast was, we're going to get slammed and we're going to Monday. And it just kind of kept being pushed back, pushed back, pushed back. And by the time Jimmy Walker got to the 10th green, it seemed pretty clear we had a really good chance to get this in. And fortunately, they did. And the final 30 minutes were really cool. Again, if you're going to rank the majors from this year, I think you have to look at the British Open as the best. That the Open Championship duel between Stenson and Mickelson is number one, not only this year, but maybe all of eternity. I think Dustin Johnson at the U.S. Open is number two. And because of the storyline of trying to beat the USGA, trying to beat himself, trying to beat Oakmont, he didn't have a direct enemy, really. I mean, he had challengers. It's got Piercy, Jim Furyk, Sergio, Lee Westwood, Jason Day were all a part of the mix late in the tournament, but it never really felt like they were huge threats to him in the final three holes. The threat was from the USGA to give him strokes, so he had to win by two. The threat was from Oakmont being an insanely difficult golf course. The threat was from himself because he's blown this five times in his career with a good chance to win. But he didn't cave, which I think is awesome. Then you have Danny Willett, because he's the shock champion. I take shock champion over solid play in terms of excitement, because Jordan Spieth put two in the drink on 12. And Danny Willett was right there to play great golf on Sunday and snatch up that green jacket. That's what you're supposed to do. When it falls in your lap, you hold on for all you got. And then you've got Jimmy Walker, who, again, played a wonderful golf tournament amid a lot of chaos, did great in the 36-hole final day, but Baltusrol was kind of boring. It was rainy throughout the week. No one cared till Sunday. He didn't have to play with Jason Day in the final group. Those are the downsides. So there's your ranking for the four major championships this year. And I'd love to hear your thoughts on the matter as well. Shoot me a tweet at Ryan Ballingy. If you want to do email, ryan@thegolfnewsnet.com is cool as well. So let's bring in Shane Battier. Again, we recorded this interview earlier in the week on Monday morning with him, so we've got the results of the PGA Championship in hand when we're talking. And we had a great phone conversation, about 12 to 15 minutes with him, just talking about his foundation's work, how that ties in with golf, and what he's been able to learn from golf as well, what we can learn from a professional athlete who's been successful at the collegiate and professional basketball level, winning championships in both levels, and what he can translate from that sport of basketball, a team sport, to an individual sport of golf as he's trying to get better at it. So we'll bring in Shane. We'll let you listen to that, and then we'll come back and wrap up the show.
Shane, thanks for being with us. First, let's take a little bit of time to talk about the Battier Take Charge Foundation and your work with it and how long you've put the time into this and what it means for you now that you're through with your NBA career.
Well, I feel so blessed in my life to have two parents that gave me every opportunity educationally to help me reach my dreams. And so growing up, I always thought, look, if I make it, I'm going to use my platform and my influence to provide access and opportunity to those who just don't have those two resources. And so that's why we started the Battier Take Charge Foundation in this form about 6-7 years ago, and really proud of the progress we've made. We have a scholarship program. We award college scholarships to at-risk underserved youth in Miami and Houston and in Detroit, and really feel blessed to be a part of some special kids' journey who just need a shot, just like I did growing up in Birmingham, Michigan. All I needed was a shot. Give me a shot. I'm going to make the most of it, and that's what we're trying to do with the kids in our program. And so we're really excited about our program, really, really proud of the work that we've done because we are out there changing our communities.
You guys ran a promotion or a contest in connection with DraftKings for the PGA Championship, the year's final major. Folks could donate for $10, and then they would be that would be matched by DraftKings and donated to the foundation. How was the response to that, and how was it to work with DraftKings on that contest?
Well, DraftKings have been a great partner with the Batty A Take Charge Foundation. We actually started this contest last year, and we had some really good success. And I love playing DraftKings with my buddies, and I got to know Jason Robbins, CEO, fellow Duke guy. And he said, hey, let's do something for the Take Charge Foundation. So I said, of course, I'm playing DraftKings already. So we decided on a tournament for the PGA Championship, and the winner gets to enter for $10. And if they win, they get a round of golf with me, all expense paid, down in beautiful Miami in the fall. And so it's a win-win. You get to play DraftKings, enjoy sports, and get a fun trip down to Miami to play some golf. So it was great. We're thankful for DraftKings for their support of the event. And DraftKings actually wrote a $10,000 check to the Batty A Take Charge Foundation, which is going to fund two scholarships in the coming year. So it's really a win-win for all.
As you've transitioned away from the NBA and transitioned to post-NBA life, how has golf become a little bit of a part of the gap that might come from not having to get up quite as early and stay quite as late in the gym?
Well, there's a huge vacuum for ex-athletes, especially at the professional level, searching for the next thing that can fill that void for competition. So for me, it's golf. And I caught the bug when I played, and I didn't have much time to play during the NBA season. But in the summer, you'd find me on the range hitting balls, working on my short game. And now that I retire and have a little more time to work on my game, and I really enjoy it. It's a great time of camaraderie with my buddies, and my weekly game is something I always look forward to. And I've improved steadily. I'm down to about a 12. I've hit a little bit of a plateau, but it's something that I read about, and I'm if you look at my YouTube search history, it's probably every golf video on YouTube. So I have the bug. I'm trying to get better, trying to get down to the magical single digit handicap, and it's been a fun journey.
Now, are there guys that you played with in your career that you've now suddenly found in a regular foursome, or who are the guys that you typically play golf with?
The best athlete that I've played with is Ray Allen. And he's that annoying guy who just does everything well. He's got the picture perfect jump shot, but his golf swing is as smooth as his jumper. And he's a scratch, legitimate scratch golfer. A lot of guys say they're scratch. He's legitimate, and super fun to play with. And so I take his money every now and then, but he's just really, really consistent. Nothing flashy, just green fairways and greens.
And who are the guys that, when you turn on golf on TV, that you most identify with, that you find most compelling and interesting?
I love watching DJ, and I was super happy that he won the U.S. Open, but he's just so compelling because he really is an instinctual golfer. And you don't really think about golfers being instinctual, but in past years, that was always what held him back from winning majors on Sundays. Maybe he could have afforded a little more thought, but something clicked the U.S. Open, which was an amazing, amazing U.S. Open that he performed under the scrutiny and the pressure and the possible rules violation. So I just, I love watching DJ. I love the young guys, man. Rory's so fun to watch. Jason Day. golf is just is so fun right now. So many great personalities.
What did you think of the outcome yesterday of the PGA? Jimmy Walker got it done on a 36-hole kind of marathon day with that battle that escalated at the end with Jason Day to be pretty exciting. What was your takeaway from it? What did you think of the whole tournament?
Oh, well, you know, it was a little bit boring for the most part, but Jimmy Walker did his best to make it interesting. And, you know, everyone had the same reaction. It was like, why go for the green in two? You know, lay it up, take your medicine. And luckily he was able to see the ball and got up and down from that lie. But man, that would have been a really, really tough thing for all of us to watch. So when he made that putt, I was pretty happy. You know, I love Jason Day, obviously, but you know he's going to contend for a lot more majors than Jimmy Walker. But it's always fun to see someone win their first major, because even though guys don't admit it, when you win a championship, there's a certain amount of validation, and you don't have to keep answering that question. Why haven't you done it when the pressure's highest? And so the guys, all four winners this year were first time major winners, and it's always interesting to see how they handle the pressure of the big tournaments coming up.
Is there a validation factor into winning the second one? Because a bunch of guys asked Dustin Johnson going into the PGA, are you as interested in winning a second major as you seem to be in winning the first major? Because that got the monkey off your back. But now, is there a bigger threat, or is there a bigger threat of a letdown trying to reach that second major? How does that work for a professional athlete who's trying to go and basically redo what they've already done? How difficult it already is to do that the first time?
Well, that's really interesting. You know, I think most athletes have two reactions. I think the guys who get it done on that stage, a lot of them will rationalize, well, I've already done it before, and so maybe I don't need to grind as hard or work as hard because I've been validated. But then you have the other side of the animal, this other side of the coin, where guys who say, you know what, I won one, I want two. If I win two, I want three. And, people always want to build their legacy. And, for the true competitors, they always want one more, and they get greedy. And once you get that taste of that champagne after a championship, there's no better feeling. There's no better taste. There's no better feeling than that victory champagne. And so, for us, when we won the second championship of Miami back to back, it was almost better, because you know what it takes to win a championship, and you understand how difficult it is. When you never won a championship before, you don't know what it's about. You fight like hell and you hope the effort's good enough. When you finally do it, you say, holy cow, that takes a lot to win. And so that's why repeat winners and guys who can do it again and again and again, they're special players.
Do you think that affected the Golden State Warriors in a sense, getting as they did from world champion to 73-win regular season to trying to live up to that, both of those standards, and trying to get through the finals of the team that they had that seemingly on paper was a good match, if not a way overmatch for the Cavs. And then they didn't really seem to live up to that standard after getting down 3-1. Obviously, they made the big comeback in the Western Conference Finals, but then they kind of just languished throughout the playoffs. Do you think there was some sense of that among those guys?
You cannot replicate the hunger of someone who hasn't won it yet. You just can't. And as much as Golden State wanted it, there is not the hunger that they had the year before. It's a different sort of hunger. Cleveland and LeBron was starving for a championship, literally starving. And you saw by his effort that there was no one who's going to deny him. And you don't know what Golden State's thinking. At some point, you may say to yourself, hey, you know, we won last year. It's okay. It's okay if I don't dive for that loose ball, or it's okay if I don't run back on defense, or it's okay I don't do that extra effort. Well, when you're starving for a championship, you will do anything. And, you know, we found that out the hard way going for our third championship. The Spurs just had a hunger that we couldn't replicate. And ultimately, it wasn't talent, it wasn't scheme, that was the difference. They had the hunger, and we were a little bit satiated after two championships.
Do you think that's a bigger edge in golf as an individual sport, of the desire to want it more, or does that play more into a team sport where you have to have, in your guys' case, 5 on the floor, 14 in the, you know, deep on the bench? Everyone kind of has to have that same level of desire to accomplish a common goal.
Oh, well, it's different for every player, but I don't think you could have watched the British Open, the Open Championship this year, and not said, wow, Stenson would literally do anything to win this championship. And Phil played amazing too. But the level of focus that Henrik Stenson, the hunger that he showed, the intensity that he showed, was the most mesmerizing thing about the Open. And you could really say that about all the major winners this year. They all smelled it. They were all in position to go and get it. And they did. With that said, I mean, you still had the blue bloods knocking on the door every single tournament, and you know, that's why those guys are special as well.
What do you learn from those guys or those situations in your life, you know, competitively, where you didn't get the job done? What do you take away from those situations that prepare you for the next time, either to get you ready to win the next time, or teach you something about yourself? What are those situations like in moving you forward,
yeah,
instead of moving you backward?
You know, a lot of people focus on the back nine on a Sunday. So a lot of people will, you know, look at Stenson's round and at the PGA and say, well, you know, he shouldn't have gone for it and had a Waywood, wedge shot in. And people always try to pinpoint a loss on one or two plays in the fourth quarter or in crunch time. But, you know, you learn it's the play in the first quarter, or it's the shot on Thursday that ultimately gets magnified on Sunday or in the fourth quarter. And so you understand, to be a champion, you got to grind from the beginning. And it's not about turning it on or doing something spectacular down the stretch. That's what most people remember. But it's the consistency, and it's the giving yourself a shot, even when you don't have your best game, to hang around, to be able to make a play when it's crunch time, on the back nine on Sunday, or in the fourth quarter. And that's probably maybe the most difficult thing to focus on in any sport.
All right, we'll get you out of here with something about your game. What's the top two places you've ever played, and what are the two places on your bucket list that you've yet to play that you really want to get on?
Oh, man. My top three. I actually played Pine Valley last week. I went to the PGA. I got a chance to play Pine Valley, and that was a special treat. The Ocean Course on Kiawa, maybe my favorite. I love that course, and I shot, you know, in the mid-80s there, so I was pretty excited. And my hometown of Birmingham, Michigan, you get Oakland Hills, Ryder Cup track and U.S. Open track. That's a special place for me to go back and play every single time. And, you know, for me, you know, Augusta is at the top of my list. You know, I got to start making some higher class friends to get that invite. And so Augusta, I love to play Cypress, and Pebble one day. But, you know, my game is close enough where it's time for me to go to Scotland, play the old course, and do the Scotland guys trip. And so that's what's next on my list.
Awesome. Well, thank you for the time, Shane. We really appreciate it. Congrats with everything with your foundation on a successful week at the PGA Championship, and hopefully we can keep in touch and have you back on again next year around this time and talk more about winning in the PGA Championship and all kinds of good stuff. And hopefully you'll be in those single digits by then.
Thanks so much, Ryan.
Thanks, Shane.
Thank you to Shane Battier for being a part of the program. He was awesome to talk to. He could not have been more eloquent. He's better than some guys who are on the radio that do this for a living in golf. So thanks again for being on the show. That'll do it for us this week on the program. Next week, we'll talk a little bit of Olympics. It's here, whether you like it or not. Golf in the Olympics is here. So we'll preview it a little bit. We'll talk about the Americans' chances to medal, which medals they could take. We'll talk about how this golf course is going to hold up, how the Olympics are unfolding, and where's golf's place in it. And something I'm trying to save for next week, and that is the opportunity that lies in front of golf amid what could be a historically bad Olympic Games, that if things go right, the future for Olympic golf could be good. So send me your feedback on Twitter at Ryan Ballingy, email ryan@thegolfnewsnet.com, download our apps on Google Play and the App Store. Check out BetDSI.com, our presenting sponsor. We use their betting odds every week because they're live and updated with not only updated odds, but the betting money, the percentage that's coming in on a particular player for our PGA Tour and European Tour odds posts as well. We've got an Olympic one up there too, so you can check that out just in case you're curious. So BetDSI.com for all of your legal betting needs, if that's applicable to you. Next week on the show, can't wait. Olympic golf, it should be a fun one way or the other. So please give us a 5-star review if you listen to us on iTunes. If you listen to us through some other podcasting service, we're equally grateful. There's just not a lot of easy ways to give us reviews, and we'd love it if you could send us your feedback and give us a follow on social media. So until next week, I'm Ryan Ballingy saying thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you next time on the 19th Hole Golf Show.